in your state? Oh, never mind. There is no chance that you will get a divorce. States should spell out clearly what range of support is generally acceptable as a portion of income, subjected, perhaps, to upper limits. The best approach might be an explicit formula based on such factors as the age of both spouses, their earning capabilities, the length of marriage, and so forth. Starting with the formula as an anchor, a judge could weigh other considerations such as the standard of living during the marriage, the health of the spouse seeking maintenance, the financial prospects of both sides, and other relevant factors. The reasons for any departures from the range would have to be clearly spelled out and limited to a small number of acceptable reasons for adjustment, because the whole goal of transparency in the process is to nudge couples towards settlement within an expected range. But let us conclude with our broader point. With respect to marriage, there are powerful arguments for privatization, for allowing private institutions, religious and otherwise, to do as they wish, subject to default rules and criminal prohibitions. We have argued that states should abolish marriage as such and rely on civil unions instead. If religious institutions want to restrict marriage to heterosexual couples, they should certainly be permitted to do exactly that. If such institutions want to limit divorce, that is, ending a marriage, they could do that too. The beauty of this proposal is that it would allow a wide range of experiments, increasing freedom for individuals and religious organizations alike, while at the same time reducing the unnecessary and sometimes ugly intensity of current public debates. Part 5. Extensions and Objections. Chapter 16. A Dozen Nudges. We have described a lot of nudges, but we are confident that there are countless others. Here are a dozen more. Many nudges, if you will. Readers are warmly encouraged to add to the list by sending them to our website, www.nudges.org. 1. Give more tomorrow. Many people have strong charitable impulses, and we suspect that because of inertia they give far less than they actually want to give. Their reflective system wants to be charitable, but their automatic system doesn't get around to it. How many times have you thought that you ought to provide some help, but failed to do so because the moment passed and you focused on other things? A simple nudge would be a Give More Tomorrow program. The basic idea, modeled on Save More Tomorrow, is to ask people whether they would like to give a small amount to their favorite charity starting sometime soon, then commit to increasing their donations every year. It would probably be impractical to link the increases to pay increases. If people decided to opt out of Give More Tomorrow, they need only make a quick phone call or send a brief email at any time. We suspect that many people would gladly join such a program. Anna Breeman, 2006, has conducted a pilot experiment using this idea in collaboration with a large charity. Donors already making monthly donations were asked to increase their donations either immediately or starting in 2 months. The latter group increased their donations by 32%. We are involved with some additional experiments in collaboration with our own university, and the initial results look promising. If the goal is to increase charitable giving, here's an easy way to do it. In fact, it would not be at all surprising if the Give More Tomorrow program produced far more money for those who need it, while also pleasing the well-meaning but absent-minded donors who want to give but never get around to it. 2. The Charity Debit Card and Tax Deductions. A related nudge would make it easier for people to deduct their charitable contributions. Keeping track of donations and listing them on a tax return is burdensome for some humans, who end up donating less than they would if the tax savings were automatic. An obvious solution is the Charity Debit Card, a special debit card that would be issued by banks and accepted only by charities. With the Charity Debit Card, any charitable donations are deducted from your normal account, and your bank sends you a statement at the end of the year with your donations itemized and totaled. You could also use the card to keep a record of when you donate non-monetary items like furniture or cars, ensuring that your bank would know the value of what you donated and add it to your end-of-year statement. The statement could even be sent straight to the IRS so that the government could automatically process the appropriate deduction for you. By making donations salient, Such a card could make charity simpler and more attractive. 3. The automatic tax return. Speaking of taxes and automatic processing, no sensible choice architect would design the current income tax system, which is famous for its complexity. Withholding was a major advance that simplified life for everyone. Ordinary people and the Internal Revenue Service would benefit even more if the process could be made more automatic. A simple step, suggested by the economist Austin Goolsbee, 2006, is the automatic tax return. Under this approach, anyone who does not itemize deductions and has no income, such as tips, that is not reported to the IRS would receive a tax return that is already filled out. To file, the taxpayer would need only to sign it and mail it, or even better, go to a secure IRS website, sign in and click. Of course, the taxpayer would be required to make changes if her status changed, or if she started receiving unreported income. Goolsbee estimates that this proposal would save taxpayers up to 225 million hours of tax preparation time and more than $2 billion a year in tax preparation fees. True, many people don't trust the IRS, so here's one way to assure them that our tax collectors are honest. If there's an error, you get the money back, plus a bonus, say $100. 4. Stick.com. Many people need help in achieving their goals and aspirations. Committing oneself to a specific action is one way to improve the odds of success. Sometimes it is easy to make a commitment, as, for example, by cutting up your credit cards, refusing to stock your kitchen with brownies and cashews, or having your significant other hide the TV remote until those leaves get raked. Other times it is hard. Remember the weight loss bet we described between two graduate students in Chapter 2? Well, one of them, Dean Carlin, now a Yale economics professor, has teamed up with his Yale colleague Ian Ayers to propose a web-based business based on the same concept. Ayers and Carlin call the business Stick.com. Stick.com offers two ways to make commitments, financial and non-financial. With financial commitments, an individual puts up money and agrees to accomplish a goal by a certain date. He also specifies how to verify that he has met his goal. For example, he might agree to a weigh-in at the doctor's office or a friend's house, a urine test for nicotine at the clinic, or an honor system verification. If the person reaches his goal, he gets his money back. If he fails, the money goes to charity. He also has the option to enter into a group financial commitment in which the group's pooled money is divided among those members of the group who reach their goals. A tougher, more mischievous, and perhaps even more effective option is to give the money to people the would-be committer hates, such as an opposing political party or the fan club of the home team's arch-rival, think Yankees and Red Sox. The non-financial commitments include peer pressure, emails to family or friends announcing your successes or failures, and monitoring one's own goal via a group blog. A committer's goal might be to lose weight, quit smoking, exercise more frequently, improve grades, or the like. There is even a creative section for people with idiosyncratic goals. Climb Mount Kilimanjaro while there is still ice at the summit, verification by photograph. Travel to Mongolia, verification by passport stamp. Learn to juggle 7 oranges and a watermelon, verification by video. Run a marathon, save more money, less creative to be sure. Use less gas and electricity, not too creative, but admirable, or whatever self-improvement people can conjure up and post on the website. 5. Quit smoking without a patch. Organizations already exist to help people make commitments and achieve goals. CARES, Committed Action to Reduce and End Smoking, is a savings program offered by the Green Bank of Caraga in Mindanao, Philippines. A would-be non-smoker opens an account with a minimum balance of $1. For 6 months, she deposits the amount of money she would otherwise spend on cigarettes into the account. In some cases, a representative of the bank visits every week to collect the deposits. After 6 months, the client takes a urine test to confirm that she has not smoked recently. If she passes the test, she gets her money back. If she fails the test, the account is closed and the money is donated to charity. The early results from this program have been evaluated by MIT's Poverty Action Lab and look very good. Opening up an account makes those who want to quit 53% more likely to achieve their goal. No other anti-smoking tactic, not even the nicotine patch, appears to have been so successful. 6. Motorcycle helmets. Many states ban people from riding motorcycles without helmets. To libertarians, these bans are questionable. They ask, if people want to take risks, why shouldn't they be allowed to do so? To date, an intense debate has separated the hardcore paternalists, who emphasize the dangers and support bans, from the fans of laissez-faire, who insist that the government should let people do what they want. The columnist John Tierney, 2006, has suggested a nudge-like way that states might promote safety while maintaining freedom. The basic idea is that riders who do not want to use the helmet have to get special licenses. To qualify for the license, a rider would have to take an extra driving course and submit proof of health insurance. Tierney's approach imposes some costs on those who want to feel the wind in their hair. An extra driving course and proof of insurance are not exactly trivial, but requirements of this kind are less intrusive than a ban, and might do a lot of good to boot. 7. Gambling self-bans. Gambling raises complex issues, to say the least, and we will not explore in any detail what a libertarian paternalist might do in this area. Suffice it to say that if we were in charge, we would not give state governments a monopoly on gambling, especially if they chose to specialize in gambles that offer the worst odds for customers, namely state lotteries, which pay off roughly 50 cents on the dollar. Hint: if you want to gamble with decent odds, start a football pool with your friends. However, it is clear that gambling addicts are among us, and they need real help. Here's an ingenious solution. Over the past decade, several states, including Illinois, Indiana, and Missouri, have enacted laws enabling gambling addicts to put themselves on a list that bans them from entering casinos or collecting gambling winnings. The underlying thought is that someone who has self-control problems is aware of her shortcomings and wants to put her reflective system in control of her automatic system. Sometimes recreational gamblers can do this on their own or with their friends. Sometimes private institutions can help them. But addicted gamblers might do best if they have a way to enlist the support of the state. We think that self-bans are a great idea, and suggest that research be done to explore ways to use this concept in other domains. 8. Destiny Health Plan. Insurance companies don't like paying large medical bills any more than patients do. There is room for some creative efforts on the part of such companies to work with their customers to improve people's health while reducing medical bills for all. Consider here the Destiny Health Plan now offered in 4 states: Illinois, Wisconsin, Michigan, and Colorado. The plan features a health vitality program explicitly designed to give people an incentive to make healthy choices. A participant is able to earn vitality bucks if he works out at a health club in a particular week, has a child join a soccer league, or completes a blood pressure check with normal results. Vitality bucks can be used to obtain airline tickets, hotel rooms, magazine subscriptions, and electronics. The Destiny Health Plan is a clever effort to combine health insurance with nudges designed to get people to live healthier lives. 9. Dollar a day. Teenage pregnancy is a serious problem for many girls, and those who have one child at, say, 18, often become pregnant again within a year or two. Several cities, including Greensboro, North Carolina, have experimented with a dollar a day program, by which teenage girls with a baby receive a dollar for each day in which they are not pregnant. Thus far, the results have been extremely promising. A dollar a day is a trivial cost to the city, even for a year or two, so the plan's total cost is extremely low, but the small recurring payment is salient enough to encourage teenage mothers to take steps to avoid getting pregnant again. And because taxpayers end up paying a significant amount for many children born to teenagers, the costs appear to be far less than the benefits. Many people are touting dollar a day as a model program for helping reduce teenage pregnancies. Surely there are more such programs to be invented. Consider that a nudge to think of one. 10. Filters for air conditioners, the helpful red light. In hot weather, people depend on air conditioners, and many central air conditioning systems need their filters changed regularly. If the filter isn't changed, bad things can happen. For example, the system can freeze and break down. Unfortunately, it is not easy to remember when to change the filter, and not surprisingly, many people are left with huge repair bills. The solution is simple. People should be informed via a red light in a relevant and conspicuous place that the filter needs to be changed. Many contemporary cars notify people when the oil needs to be changed, and many new refrigerators have a warning light for their built-in water filters. The same can be done with air conditioners. 11. No-bite nail polish and disulfiram. People who hope to change certain bad habits might want to buy products that make it unpleasant or painful to continue to indulge these habits. Through this route, the reflective system can choose to discipline the automatic system through products that tell the automatic system, "Stop." Several products now accomplish exactly this task. Those who want to stop biting their nails can buy bitter nail polishes such as Mavala and Orly No Bite. A more extreme version of this concept is disulfiram, antabuse, which is given to some alcoholics. Disulfiram causes alcohol drinkers to throw up and suffer a hangover as soon as they start to drink. For some people suffering from chronic alcoholism, disulfiram has had a strong and positive effect as part of a treatment program. 12. The civility check. We have saved our favorite proposal for last. The modern world suffers from insufficient civility. Every hour of every day, people send angry emails they soon regret, cursing people they barely know, or even worse, their friends and loved ones. A few of us have learned a simple rule: don't send an angry email in the heat of the moment. File it, and wait a day before you send it. In fact, the next day you may have calmed down so much that you forget even to look at it. So much the better. But many people either haven't learned the rule or don't always follow it. Technology could easily help. In fact, we have no doubt that technology-savvy types could design a helpful program by next month. We propose a civility check that can accurately tell whether the email you're about to send is angry and caution you, "Warning, this appears to be an uncivil email. Do you really and truly want to send it?" Software already exists to detect foul language. What we are proposing is more subtle, because it is easy to send a really awful email message that does not contain any four-letter words. A stronger version, which people could choose or which might be the default, would say, "Warning, this appears to be an uncivil email. This will not be sent unless you ask to resend in 24 hours. With the stronger version, you might be able to bypass the delay with some work by inputting, say, your social security number and your grandfather's birth date, or maybe by solving some irritating math problem. The reflective system can be nicer as well as smarter than the automatic system. Sometimes it's even smart to be nice. We think that humans would be better off if they gave a boost to what Abraham Lincoln called the better angels of our nature. Chapter 17. Objections. Who would oppose nudges? We are aware that hardline anti-paternalists, and possibly others, will have serious objections. Let us consider the possible counter-arguments in sequence. We begin with those that seem to us weakest, and then turn to those that raise more complicated issues. The slippery slope. It is tempting to worry that those who embrace libertarian paternalism are starting down an alarmingly slippery slope. Skeptics might fear that once we accept modest paternalism for savings or cafeteria lines or environmental protection, highly intrusive interventions will surely follow. They might object that if we permit information campaigns that encourage people to conserve energy, a government propaganda machine will move rapidly from education to outright manipulation to coercion and bans. The critics could easily envisage an onslaught of what seem, to them, to be unacceptably intrusive forms of paternalism. Governments that start with education might end with stiff fines and even prison terms. The case of cigarettes offers a possible example. Here we have gone from modest warning labels to much more aggressive information campaigns, to high cigarette taxes, to bans on smoking in public places, and a smoker would not have to be paranoid to think that the day might eventually come when cigarettes are heavily regulated or even banned altogether. Indeed, many would welcome this for cigarettes, though most would not for alcohol. Where do we stop? Sliding all the way down the slippery slope is unlikely, to be sure, but faced with the risk of overreaching, critics might think that it is better to avoid starting to slide at all. We have three responses to this line of attack. The first is that reliance on a slippery slope argument ducks the question of whether our proposals have merit in and of themselves. If our proposals help people save more, eat better, invest more wisely, and choose better insurance plans and credit cards, in each case only when they want to, isn't that a good thing? If our policies are unwise, then it would be constructive to criticize them directly rather than to rely only on the fear of a hypothetical slippery slope. And if our proposals are worthwhile, then let's make progress on those and do whatever it takes to pour sand on the slope, assuming that we really are worried about how slippery it is. The second response is that our own libertarian condition, requiring low-cost opt-out rights, reduces the steepness of the ostensibly slippery slope. Our proposals are empathically designed to retain freedom of choice. In many domains, from education to environmental protection to medical malpractice to marriage, we would create such freedom where it does not now exist. So long as paternalistic interventions can be easily avoided by those who seek to adopt a course of their own, the risks decreed by anti-paternalists are modest. Slippery slope arguments are most convincing when it is not possible to distinguish the proposed course of action from abhorrent, unacceptable, or scary courses of action. Because libertarian paternalists retain freedom of choice, we can say, with conviction, that our own approach opposes the most objectionable kinds of government intervention. The third point is one that we have emphasized throughout. In many cases, some kind of nudge is inevitable, and so it is pointless to ask government simply to stand aside. Choice architects, whether private or public, must do something. If the government is going to adopt a prescription drug plan, some sort of choice architecture must be put in place. With respect to pollution, rules have to be established, even if only to say that polluters face no liability and may pollute with impunity. Even if states dispensed with both marriage and civil unions, contract law would have to be available to say what disbanding couples owe each other, if anything. Often life turns up problems that people do not anticipate. Both private and public institutions need rules to determine how such situations are handled. When those rules seem invisible, it is because people find them so obvious and so sensible that they do not see them as rules at all. But the rules are nonetheless there, and sometimes they are not so sensible. Those who object to nudges might accept this point for the private sector. Perhaps they believe that competitive pressures can combat the worst kinds of nudges. Rental car or cell phone companies that push people in bad directions might find themselves losing customers. We have raised questions about this view, and we will raise some more. But let us put those questions to one side and focus on the slippery slope argument for government alone. Those who make this argument sometimes speak as if government can be absent, as if the default terms that set the background come from nature or from the sky. This is a big mistake. To be sure, the default terms that now apply in any particular context might be best, in the sense that they promote people's interests overall or on balance. But that view must be defended, not assumed. And it would be odd for those who generally hold government in extremely low esteem to think that in all domains, past governments have somehow stumbled onto a set of ideal arrangements. Evil nudgers and bad nudges. In offering supposedly helpful nudges, choice architects may have their own agendas. Those who favor one default rule over another may do so because their own economic interests are at stake. When companies offer you a special rate for the first month, then automatically re-enroll you in the program at a higher rate after the end of the introductory period, their primary motivation is not to save you the trouble of signing up for yourself. So let's go on record as saying that choice architects in all walks of life have incentives to nudge people in directions that benefit the architects, or their employers, rather than the users. But what conclusion should we draw from this observation? Real architects can have conflicts of interest with their clients as well, but we don't think they should stop designing buildings. Instead, we try to line up incentives when we can, and employ monitoring and transparency when we can't. One question is whether we should worry even more about public choice architects than private choice architects. Maybe so, but we worry about both. On the face of it, it is odd to say that the public architects are always more dangerous than the private ones. After all, managers in the public sector have to answer to voters, and managers in the private sector have as their mandate the job of maximizing profits and share prices, not consumer welfare. Indeed, some of those who are most suspicious of governments think that the only responsibility of private managers is to maximize share prices. As we have emphasized, the invisible hand will, in some circumstances, lead those trying to maximize profits to maximize consumer welfare too. But when consumers are confused about the features of the products they are buying, it can be profit-maximizing to exploit their confusion, especially in the short run, but possibly in the long run too. The invisible hand works best when products are simple and purchased frequently. We worry very little about consumers being ripped off by their dry cleaners. A dry cleaner who loses shirts or suddenly doubles prices will not be in business long. But a mortgage broker who fails to point out that the teaser rate will disappear quickly is long gone by the time the customer gets the bad news. The editors of The Economist, in a largely sympathetic treatment of libertarian paternalism, offer this cautionary note. From the point of view of liberty, there is a serious danger of overreach, and therefore grounds for caution. Politicians, after all, are hardly strangers to the art of framing the public's choices and rigging its decisions for partisan ends. And what is to stop lobbyists, axe grinders, and busybodies of all kinds of hijacking the whole effort? We agree that government officials, elected or otherwise, are often captured by private sector interests whose representatives are seeking to nudge people in directions that will specifically promote their selfish goals. That is one reason that we want to maintain freedom of choice. But if private sector interests are just following the invisible hand in furthering the interests of their customers, what's the problem? The more serious point is that we should be worried about all choice architects, public and private alike. We should create rules of engagement that reduce fraud and other abuses, that promote healthy competition, that restrict interest group power, and that create incentives to make it more likely that the architects will serve the public interest. In both the public and private sectors, a primary goal should be to increase transparency. Our various recap proposals are specifically designed to make it easier for consumers to figure out how much of some service they are using and how much they are paying for it. In the environmental domain, we have suggested that disclosure can be an effective and low-cost monitoring device. We would love to see similar principles used to monitor governments. Require government officials to put all their votes, earmarks, and contributions from lobbyists on their websites. Require those determining the future of energy policy, to cite a random example, to reveal which profit-maximizing firms were invited to lend their all-too-invisible hands to the process of designing the rules. Require those determining the future of educational policy to reveal which interest groups and which unions gave them money in the most recent campaign. Require government agencies, not merely the private sector, to disclose their contributions to air and water pollution and their greenhouse gas emissions. Supreme Court Justice Lou Brandeis urged that sunlight is the best of disinfectants. Democratic governments, as well as authoritarian ones, could use a lot more sunlight. In emphasizing the effects of plan design on choice, we hope to encourage plan designers to become more informed. And by arguing for a libertarian check on bad plans, we hope to create a strong safeguard against ill-considered or ill-motivated plans. To the extent that individual self-interest is a healthy check on planners, freedom of choice is an important corrective. The right to be wrong. Skeptics might argue that in a free society, people have the right to be wrong, and it is sometimes helpful for us to make mistakes, since that is how we learn. On the first point, we heartily agree, which is why we insist on opt-out rights. If people really want to invest their entire retirement portfolio in high-tech Romanian stocks, we say go for it. But for unsophisticated choosers, there is little harm in putting some warning signs along the way. We approve of the signs at some ski areas warning novice and intermediate skiers, don't even think about going down this hill if you are not an expert. We worry more about poor people who were duped into taking a mortgage that they would soon be unable to afford than about the investment firms that bought portfolios of those mortgages. That latter group should have known better, though better disclosure would help there too, and they are likely to devise improved methods of evaluating the risks of loans on their own. But how much learning do you think is good for people? We do not believe that children should learn the dangers of swimming pools by falling in and hoping for the best. Should pedestrians in London get hit by a double-decker bus to teach them to look right? Isn't a reminder on the sidewalk better? Of punishment, redistribution, and choice. Some of our most extreme critics offer an objection that will strike many readers as just odd. Those critics object to any forced exchanges. They don't like to take anything from Peter to give it to Paul, even if Peter is very rich and Paul is very poor. They obviously oppose progressive taxes. Well, most taxes, actually. In the areas that concern us, these critics would disapprove of policies that explicitly benefit the weak, poor, uneducated, or unsophisticated. They would object to those policies not because they lack sympathy for these groups, but because they think that any help for them should come voluntarily from the private sector, such as from charities, and that government policies would come at the expense of other groups, often the strong, rich, educated, and sophisticated. They don't like any government policy that takes resources from some in order to assist others. We must confess that we do not share the view that all redistribution is illegitimate. We think that a good society makes trade-offs between protecting the unfortunate and encouraging initiative and self-help, between giving everyone a decent share of the pie and increasing the size of the pie. In our view, the optimal level of redistribution is not zero. But even those who hate redistribution more than we do should have little concern about our policies. Most of the time, nudging helps those who need help while imposing minimal costs on those who do not. If people are already saving for retirement, offering the Save More Tomorrow program will cause them no problems. If people are not smoking, or are naturally or unnaturally thin, campaigns to help smokers and the obese will do them little harm. Some skeptics might object that some of our proposals would require the econs to pay something, not a lot, for programs they don't need and for which they don't benefit. But if the people who need the help are also imposing costs on society, for example, through higher health costs, then having the econs share in the costs of helping the humans seems like a modest price to pay. Of course, some anti-redistributive types will object to a health system that forces the rest of us to pay for those who need health care. And it is true that on a relative basis the econs may still lose out from policies that help humans. If Peter's happiness depends, in part, on him being richer than Paul, then anything that pulls Paul up by his bootstraps makes Peter worse off. But we think, though we admit to having no evidence to support our view, that most Peters actually take pleasure in helping out the worst-off members of society, even if the Pauls are being helped by government rather than by private charity. As for those who feel miserable if their poorest neighbors close some of the gap, they have our sympathy, but not our empathy. The most ardent libertarians have another arrow in their quiver. They are concerned about liberty and free choice rather than about welfare. For this reason, they prefer required choosing to nudges. At most, they would like to provide people with the information necessary to make an informed choice and then tell people to choose for themselves. No nudges. This view is reflected in the campaign by the Swedish government to get citizens to choose their own investment portfolios and the idea that for organ donations, people should be asked to make their wishes clear without any default rule. Both policies represent a deliberate decision not to nudge. Although nudges are often unavoidable, we enthusiastically agree that required, or even strongly encouraged, active choosing is sometimes the right route, and we have no problem with providing information and educational campaigns. We are professors, after all. But forced choosing is not always best. When the choices are hard and the options are numerous, requiring people to choose for themselves might be preferred and might not lead to the best decisions. Given that people would often choose not to choose, it is hard to see why freedom lovers should compel choice even though people, freely and voluntarily, resist it. If we ask the waiter to select a good bottle of wine to go with our dinner, we will not be happy if he says that we should just choose for ourselves. As for information and educational campaigns, one of the main lessons from psychology is that it is impossible for such programs to be neutral, regardless of how scrupulously designers try to achieve that goal. So to put it simply, forcing people to choose is not always wise, and remaining neutral is not always possible. Drawing lines and the publicity principle. A while back, Sunstein took his teenage daughter to Lollapalooza, the 3-day rock festival held every year in Chicago. On Friday night, a huge sign, with changing electronic messages, often showed the schedule of performances, but interspersed that information with a message saying, "Drink more water." The print was large, and the message was accompanied by another one, "You sweat in the heat, you lose water." What was the point of this announcement? Chicago had been in the midst of a terrible heat wave, and those who ran Lollapalooza were clearly trying to prevent the various health problems that are associated with dehydration. The sign was a nudge. No one was forced to drink, but those who produced the sign were sensitive to how people think. In particular, the choice of the particular words "more water" was excellent. Those words were likely to be far more effective than blander alternatives, such as "drink enough water" or "drink water." The suggestion that we lose water cleverly invoked loss aversion on behalf of staying hydrated. As it happens, Sunstein wished that he had seen the sign earlier. He became very thirsty during the performance of the band Death Cab for Cutie, but the crowd was so densely packed that it was impossible to go out to find water. Now compare an imaginable alternative. Suppose that instead of having a visible "drink more water" sign, the schedules for the day were briefly and invisibly interrupted by subliminal advertising. The subliminal advertisement might say, "Drink more water. Aren't you thirsty?" Or, "Don't drink and drive. Drugs kill." Or, "Support your president. Abortion is murder." Or, "Buy 10 copies of Nudge." Can subliminal advertising be seen as a form of libertarian paternalism? After all, it steers people's choices, but it does not make their decisions for them. So do we embrace subliminal advertising, so long as it is in the interest of desirable ends? What limits should be placed on private or public manipulation as such? A general objection to libertarian paternalism, and to certain kinds of nudges, might be that they are insidious, that they empower government to maneuver people in its preferred directions, and at the same time provide officials with excellent tools by which to accomplish that task. Compare subliminal advertising to something just as cunning. If you want people to lose weight, one effective strategy is to put mirrors in the cafeteria. When people see themselves in the mirror, they may eat less if they are chubby. Is that okay? And if mirrors are acceptable, what about mirrors that are intentionally unflattering? We seem to run into more of those every year. Are such mirrors an acceptable strategy for our friend Carolyn in the cafeteria? If so, what should we think about flattering mirrors in a fast food restaurant? To approach these problems, we once again rely on one of our guiding principles, transparency. In this context, we endorse what the philosopher John Rawls, 1971, called the publicity principle. In its simplest form, the publicity principle bans government from selecting a policy that it would not be able or willing to defend publicly to its own citizens. We like this principle on two grounds. The first is practical. If a government adopts a policy that it would not defend publicly, it stands to face considerable embarrassment, and perhaps much worse, if the policy and its grounds are disclosed. Those who participated in, or sanctioned, the cruel and degrading actions in the Abu Ghraib prison might have benefited from using this principle. The second and more important ground involves the idea of respect. The government should respect the people whom it governs, and if it adopts policies that it would not defend in public, it fails to manifest that respect. Instead, it treats its citizens as tools for its own manipulation. In this sense, the publicity principle is connected with the prohibition on lying. Someone who lies treats people as means, not as ends. We think that the publicity principle is a good guideline for constraining and implementing nudges in both the public and private sectors. Consider Save More Tomorrow. Here people are explicitly informed of the nature of the proposal and specifically asked whether they would like to accept it. Similarly, when firms adopt automatic enrollment, they do not make a secret of it and can say honestly that they do so because they think that most workers will be better off joining the plan. Can firms say the same about forcing employees to hold shares of company stock? The same conclusion holds for legal default rules. If government alters such rules to encourage organ donation or to reduce age discrimination, it should not be secretive about what it is doing. The same can be said for educational campaigns that enlist behavioral findings in order to provide a helpful nudge. If government officials use cleverly worded signs to reduce litter, deter the theft of petrified wood, or encourage people to register as organ donors, they should be happy to reveal both their methods and their motives. Consider an advertisement from a few years ago showing an egg frying on a hot stove with the voiceover, "This is your brain on drugs." The vivid image was designed to trigger fear of drug use. The advertisement might well be deemed manipulative, but it did not violate the publicity principle. We readily agree that hard cases are imaginable. In the abstract, subliminal advertising does seem to run afoul of the publicity principle. People are outraged by such advertising because they are being influenced without being informed of that fact. But what if the use of subliminal advertising were disclosed in advance? What if the government openly announces that it will be relying on subliminal advertising in order, for example, to combat violent crime, excessive drinking, and the failure to pay one's taxes? Is disclosure enough? We tend to think that it is not, that manipulation of this kind is objectionable precisely because it is invisible and thus impossible to monitor. Neutrality. We have stressed that in many situations government cannot be purely neutral, but a form of neutrality is sometimes both feasible and important. Consider the case of voting. Ballots have to list candidates in some order. It is well known that candidates benefit from being first. One study finds that a candidate whose name is listed first gains about 3.5 percentage points in the voting. No one should be happy about a situation in which governments, which is to say incumbents, are allowed to choose the order of the candidates' names. With respect to ballot design, a principle of neutrality makes a lot of sense, and in that context, neutrality is often thought to require randomness. Why, then, do we think that governments should be trusted with nudging Medicare participants toward the insurance plan that is best for them, or with paying for ads that tell people not to mess with Texas? Why is randomizing ballots good and randomizing assignment to insurance policies bad? Part of the answer is that sometimes people have a right, even a constitutional right, to government neutrality of a certain kind. With respect to the right to vote, the government must avoid deliberate nudging in a particular sense that its choice architecture cannot favor any particular candidate. Something similar can be said about the right to free exercise of religion and the right to free speech. Government may not encourage people to join a Pray for Jesus More Tomorrow plan or a Dissent Less Tomorrow plan. Outside the context of constitutional rights, there is a more general question about neutrality, and it extends to both the private and the public sectors. We have criticized firms that nudge their employees into owning excessive amounts of company stock, but we have applauded companies that nudge some of their employees into saving more. Our basic conclusion is that the evaluation of nudges depends on their effects, on whether they hurt people or help them. Skeptics might argue that in some domains, it is best to avoid nudges altogether. But how can firms do that? It is not possible to avoid choice architecture, and in that sense it is not possible to avoid influencing people. We agree that in some cases, forced choosing is best. But often it is not feasible, and sometimes it is more trouble than it is worth. True, some kinds of nudges are not inevitable. Education and advertising campaigns are optional, and they can be avoided. Should governments educate people about the risks of smoking and drinking, unprotected sex, trans fats, spike-heeled shoes? Should employers offer educational campaigns about similar topics? To answer these questions, we need to know something about the nudgers and the nudgees. One question is whether an outside agent, the nudger, is likely to be able to help an individual, the nudgee, make a better choice. Part of this depends on how hard the choices are for the nudgees. As we have seen, people are most likely to need nudges for decisions that are difficult, complex, and infrequent, and when they have poor feedback and few opportunities for learning. But the potential for beneficial nudging also depends on the ability of the nudgers to make good guesses about what is best for the nudgees. In general, nudgers will be able to make good guesses when they have much more expertise at their disposal, and when the differences in individuals' tastes and preferences are either not very big, nearly everyone prefers chocolate ice cream to licorice, or when differences in tastes and needs can be easily detected, as when the government deduces that you are likely to prefer a drug plan that offers you low prices on the drugs you take regularly. For all the reasons we have discussed, nudging makes more sense for mortgages than for soft drinks. Mortgages are complicated, and outsiders can provide a lot of help. By contrast, no expert has much to offer about whether you are likely to prefer Coke to Pepsi that would not be better answered by taking a sip of each. So to summarize, when choices are fraught, when nudgers have expertise, and when differences in individual preferences are either not important or can be easily estimated, then the potential for helpful nudging is high. Of course, we need to be worried about incompetence and self-dealing on the part of nudgers. If the nudgers are incompetent, then they could easily do more harm than good by directing people's choices. And if the risk of self-dealing is high, then it is right to be wary of attempts to nudge. There are some who think that any decisions made by a government official is likely to be incompetent and corrupt. Those who hold this view would want government-sponsored nudging to be kept to a bare minimum, that is, limited to cases in which some nudging is inevitable, such as choosing default options. But for those with less pessimistic views about government, who think politicians and bureaucrats are just humans, not much more likely to be stupid or dishonest than, say, business executives, lawyers, or economists, we can ask whether a situation contains special risks of self-dealing. This makes it clear why leaving ballot designs to politicians is an obviously bad idea, whereas letting politicians hire experts to help pick sensible default options for Medicare participants is probably a good idea, especially if politicians have to report donations from insurance companies. Why stop at libertarian paternalism? We hope that conservatives, moderates, liberals, self-identified libertarians, and many others might be able to endorse libertarian paternalism. So far, we have emphasized the criticisms of certain conservatives and the most ardent libertarians. A different set of objections can be expected from the opposite direction. Enthusiastic paternalists might well feel emboldened by evidence of human frailties. So emboldened, they might urge that in many domains, nudging and libertarian paternalism are much too modest and cautious. If we want to protect people, why not go further? In some circumstances, wouldn't people's lives go best if we took away freedom of choice? The truth, of course, is that there are no hard and fast stopping points. We have defined libertarian paternalism to include actions, rules, and other nudges that can be easily avoided by opting out. We do not have a clear definition of easily avoided, but we hold up one-click paternalism to be as close as we can get with existing technology. We can hope for one-thought or one-blink technology in the near future. Our goal is to allow people to go their own way at the lowest possible cost. To be sure, some of the policies we have advocated impose higher costs than one-click. To opt out of an automatic enrollment plan, an employee typically has to fill out and return some form, not a big cost, but more than one click. It would be arbitrary and a bit ridiculous to offer an inflexible rule to specify when costs are high enough to disqualify a policy as libertarian, but the precise question of degree is not really important. Let us simply say that we want those costs to be small. The real question is when we should be willing to impose some non-trivial costs in the interests of improving people's welfare. A good approach to thinking about these problems has been proposed by a collective of behavioral economists and lawyers under the rubric of asymmetric paternalism. Their guiding principle is that we should design policies that help the least sophisticated people in society while imposing the smallest possible costs on the most sophisticated. Libertarian paternalism is a form of asymmetric paternalism in which the costs imposed on the sophisticated are kept close to zero. A simple example of asymmetric paternalism involves sun lamps. Sun lamps are consumer devices that let users get a tan without going to the beach. Typically, a user will lie down under the lamp, close their eyes, and remain there for a few minutes. It is dangerous to stay under the lamp for more than a few minutes because serious burns are possible. Of course, using the lamp at all may be risking skin cancer, but we will follow the lead of the users of this appliance and ignore that issue here. It is the nature of a sun lamp that it is warm. So a choice architect who is expecting error will realize that there is a serious danger here. Some users lying under a warm lamp with their eyes closed will drift off to sleep and wake up with third-degree burns. Now let's suppose for a modest cost, the sun lamp can be equipped with a timer switch set so that it can be turned on only for brief periods, after which it shuts off automatically, a design common for the warming lamps found in some hotel bathrooms. Should the government require that all sun lamps be sold with such a switch? Asymmetrical paternalists believe that the answer depends on some kind of cost-benefit analysis. If the cost of the switch is low enough and the risk of burns is high enough, then the answer is yes. Asymmetric paternalists also endorse a class of regulations requiring cooling-off periods. The rationale is that in the heat of the moment, consumers might make ill-considered or improvident decisions. Self-control problems are the underlying concern. A mandatory cooling-off period for door-to-door sales, of the sort imposed by the Federal Trade Commission in 1972, provides an illustration. Under the FTC's rule, any door-to-door sale must be accompanied by a written statement informing the buyer of his right to rescind the purchase within 3 days of the transaction. The law came about because of complaints about high-pressure sales techniques and contracts with fine print. Again, a cost-benefit test, looking at the benefits for those who are helped and the costs for those who are not, could be used to decide when such laws would be imposed. Using such a test, regulators would want to consider how big the imposition is on those who have to wait a few days to receive the product and how often buyers would want to change their minds. When the costs are low, did anyone ever really need to buy an encyclopedia right away, even before Wikipedia was online? And there are frequent changes of heart, such a regulation makes sense to us. For certain fundamental decisions, often made on impulse, a similar strategy might well be best. Some states impose a mandatory waiting period before a couple may get divorced. Asking people to pause and think before making a decision of that magnitude seems like a sensible idea, and we are hard-pressed to think of why anyone would need to divorce immediately. True, spouses sometimes really don't like each other, but is it really terrible to have to wait a short while before the deed is done? We could easily imagine similar restrictions on the decision to marry, and some states have moved in this direction as well. Aware that people might act in a way that they will regret, regulators do not block their choices but do ensure a period for sober reflection. Note that in this regard that mandatory cooling-off periods make best sense and tend to be imposed when two conditions are met. A. People make the relevant decisions infrequently and therefore lack a great deal of experience. And B. Emotions are likely to be running high. These are the circumstances in which people are especially prone to making choices that they will regret. Occupational safety and health laws go beyond asymmetric paternalism. They impose flat bans, and they undoubtedly do hurt some people. Such laws do not permit individual workers to trade their rights to, what the government considers to be, a safe work environment in return for a higher salary, even if sophisticated and knowledgeable people might like to do that. Social Security programs do not merely encourage savings, they require it. The laws that ban discrimination on the basis of race, sex, and religion are not waivable. An employee cannot be asked to trade the right to be free from sexual harassment in return for a higher wage. These various prohibitions are not in any case libertarian, but perhaps some of them can be defended by reference to the kinds of human errors that we have explored here. Non-libertarian paternalists might like to build on such initiatives to do a great deal more, perhaps in the domains of health care and consumer protection. Many of these arguments have substantial appeal, yet we resist going further down the paternalistic path. What are the grounds for our resistance? After all, we have already granted that the costs imposed by libertarian paternalism may not be zero, So it would be disingenuous for us to say that we always and strongly object to regulations that raise the costs imposed from tiny to small. Nor do we personally oppose all mandates. But deciding where to stop and when to call a nudge a shove, much less a prison, is tricky. Where mandates are involved and opt-outs are unavailable, the slippery slope argument can begin to have some merit, especially if regulators are heavy-handed. We agree that flat bans are justified in some contexts, but they raise distinctive concerns, and in general, we prefer interventions that are more libertarian and less intrusive. We are much less cool about cooling off periods, even warm. In the right circumstances, the gains from such rules can be sufficient to make it worthwhile to make a few cautious steps down that possibly slippery slope. Chapter 18, The Real Third Way. In this book, we have made two major claims. The first is that seemingly small features of social situations can have massive effects on people's behavior. Nudges are everywhere, even if we do not see them. Choice architecture, both good and bad, is pervasive and unavoidable, and it greatly affects our decisions. The second claim is that libertarian paternalism is not an oxymoron. Choice architects can preserve freedom of choice while also nudging people in directions that will improve their lives. We have covered a great deal of territory, including savings, Social Security, credit markets, environmental policy, healthcare, marriage, and much more. But the range of potential applications is much broader than the topics we have managed to include. One of our main hopes is that an understanding of choice architecture and the power of nudges will lead others to think of creative ways to improve human lives in other domains. Many of those domains involve purely private action. Workplaces, corporate boards, universities, religious organizations, clubs, and even families might be able to use, and to benefit from, small exercises in libertarian paternalism. With respect to government, we hope that the general approach might serve as a viable middle ground in our unnecessarily polarized society. The 20th century was pervaded by a great deal of artificial talk about the possibility of a third way. We are hopeful that libertarian paternalism offers a real third way, one that can break through some of the least tractable debates in contemporary democracies. Ever since Franklin Delano Roosevelt's New Deal, the Democratic Party has shown a great deal of enthusiasm for rigid national requirements and for command and control regulation. Having identified serious problems in the private market, Democrats have often insisted on firm mandates, typically eliminating or at least reducing freedom of choice. Republicans have responded that such mandates are often uninformed or counterproductive, and that in light of the sheer diversity of Americans, one size cannot possibly fit all. Much of the time, they have argued on behalf of laissez-faire and against government intervention. At least with respect to the economy, freedom of choice has been their defining principle. To countless ordinary people, the resulting debates seem increasingly tired, abstract, and unhelpful, pointless sloganeering. Many sensible Democrats are fully aware that mandates can be ineffective and even counterproductive, and that one size may not fit all. American society is simply too diverse, individuals are simply too creative, circumstances change too rapidly, and government is simply too fallible. Many sensible Republicans know that even with free markets, government intervention cannot be avoided. Free markets depend on government, which must protect private property and ensure that contracts are enforced. In domains ranging from environmental protection to planning for retirement to assisting the needy, markets should certainly be enlisted. In fact, some of the best nudges use markets. Good choice architecture includes close attention to incentives. But there is all the difference in the world between senseless opposition to all government intervention as such and the sensible claim that when governments intervene, they should usually do so in a way that promotes freedom of choice. For all their differences, liberals and conservatives are beginning to recognize these fundamental points. No less than those in the private sector, public officials can nudge people in directions that will make their lives go better while also insisting that the ultimate choice is for individuals, not for the state. The sheer complexity of modern life and the astounding pace of technological and global change undermine arguments for rigid mandates or for dogmatic laissez-faire. Emerging developments should strengthen, at once, the principal commitment to freedom of choice and the case for the gentle nudge.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.